Chapter 7. King. He even Musil get that old frozen the cell road, yet if he don't watch out, I'll have this house painted red, white, and blue next summer, and see if that'll make his Dutch nose turn up any higher. And then Anthony Rockwall, who never cared for bells, went to the door of his library and shouted Ike, in the same voice that had once chipped off pieces of the welkin on the Kansas prairies. Tell my son, said Anthony to the answering menial, to come in here, before he leaves the house. When young Rockwall entered the library, the old man laid aside his newspaper, looked at him with a kindly grimness on his big, smooth, ruddy countenance, rumpled his mop of white hair with one hand, and rattled the keys in his pocket with the other. Richard, said Anthony Rockwall, what do you pay for the soap that you use? Richard, only 6 months home from college, was startled a little. He had not yet taken the measure of this sire of his, who was as full of unexpectednesses as a girl at her first party. $6 a dozen, I think, Dad. And your clothes? I suppose about $60, as a rule. You're a gentleman, said Anthony, decidedly. I've heard of these young bloods spending $24 a dozen for soap, and going over the 100 mark for clothes. You've got as much money to waste as any of 'em, and yet you stick to what's decent and moderate. Now I use the old Eureka, not only for sentiment, but it's the purest soap made. Whenever you pay more than 10 cents a cake for soap, you buy bad perfumes and labels. But 50 cents is doing very well for a young man in your generation, position, and condition. As I said, you're a gentleman. They say it takes 3 generations to make one. They're off. Money'll do it as slick as soap grease. It's made you one. By hokey. It's almost made one of me. I'm nearly as impolite and disagreeable and ill-mannered as these 2 old knickerbocker gents on each side of me that can't sleep of nights, because I bought in between 'em. There are some things that money can't accomplish, remarked young Rockwall, rather gloomily. Now, don't say that, said old Anthony, shocked. Bet my money on money every time. I've been through the ENCYC Wikipedia down to Y looking for something you can't buy with it, and I expect to have to take up the appendix next week. I'm for money against the field. Tell me something money won't buy. For one thing, answered Richard, rankling a little, it won't buy one into the exclusive circles of society. Oh oh, won't it? Thundered the champion of the root of evil. Who tell me where your exclusive circles would be if the first Astor hadn't had the money to pay for his steerage passage over? Richard sighed. And that's what I was coming to, said the old man, less boisterously. That's why I asked you to come in. There's something going wrong with you, boy. I've been noticing it for 2 weeks. Out with it. I guess I could lay my hands on 11 millions within 24 hours, besides the real estate. If it's your liver, there's the Rambler down in the bay, coaled, and ready to steam down to the Bahamas in 2 days. Not a bad guess, Dad. You haven't missed it far. Ah, said Anthony, keenly, what's her name? Richard began to walk up and down the library floor. There was enough comradeship and sympathy in this crude old father of his to draw his confidence. Why don't you ask her? Demanded old Anthony. He'll jump at you. You've got the money and the looks, and you're a decent boy. Your hands are clean. You've got no Eureka soap on them. You've been to college, but she'll overlook that. I haven't had a chance, said Richard. Make one, said Anthony. Take her for a walk in the park, or a straw ride, or walk home with her from church chance. Saw. You don't know the social mill, Dad. She's part of the stream that turns it. Every hour and minute of her time is arranged 4 days in advance. I must have that girl, Dad, or this town is a blackjack swamp for Vermore. And I can't write it, I can't do that. Tut, said the old man. Oh, you mean to tell me that with all the money I've got you can't get an hour or two of a girl's time for yourself? I've put it off too late. She's going to sail for Europe at noonday after tomorrow for a 2-year stay. I'm to see her alone tomorrow evening for a few minutes. She's at Larchmont now at her aunt's. I can't go there. But I'm allowed to meet her with a cab at the Grand Central Station, tomorrow evening at the 8:30 train. We drive down Broadway to Wallach's at a gallop, where her mother and a box party will be waiting for us in the lobby. Do you think she would listen to a declaration from me during that 6 or 8 minutes under those circumstances? No. And what chance would I have in the theater or afterward? None. No, Dad, this is one tangle that your money can't unravel. We can't buy 1 minute of time with cash. If we could, rich people would live longer. There's no hope of getting a talk with Miss Lantry before she sails. All right, Richard, my boy, said old Anthony, cheerfully. You may run along down to your club now. I'm glad it ain't your liver. But don't forget to burn a few punk sticks in the Joss house to the great god Mazuma from time to time. You say money won't buy time? Well, of course, you can't order eternity wrapped up and delivered at your residence for a price, but I've seen Father Time get pretty bad stone bruises on his heels when he walked through the gold diggings. That night came and Ellen, gentle, sentimental, wrinkled, sighing, oppressed by wealth, into Brother Anthony at his evening paper and began discourse on the subject of lovers' woes. He told me all about it, said Brother Anthony, yawning. Told him my bank account was at his service. And then he began to knock money. Said money couldn't help. Said the rules of society couldn't be bucked for a yard by a team of 10 millionaires. Oh, Anthony, sighed Aunt Ellen, I wish you would not think so much of money. Wealth is nothing where a true affection is concerned. Love is all powerful. If he only had spoken earlier, she could not have refused our Richard. But now I fear it is too late. He will have no opportunity to address her. All your gold cannot bring happiness to your son. At 8 o'clock the next evening Aunt Ellen took a quaint old gold ring from a moth-eaten case and gave it to Richard. Wear it tonight, nephew, she begged. Our mother gave it to me. Good luck and love, she said it brought. She asked me to give it to you when you had found the one you loved. Young Rockwall took the ring reverently and tried it on his smallest finger. It slipped as far as the second joint and stopped. He took it off and stuffed it into his vest pocket after the manner of man. And then he phoned for his cab. At the station he captured Miss Lantry out of the gadding mob at 8:32. We mustn't keep Mama and the others waiting, said she. To Wallach's Theater as fast as you can drive, said Richard loyally. They whirled up 42nd to Broadway, and then down the white-starred lane that leads from the soft meadows of sunset to the rocky hills of morning. At 34th Street young Richard quickly thrust up the trap and ordered the cabman to stop. I've dropped a ring, he apologized, as he climbed out. T was my mother's, and I'd hate to lose it. I won't detain you a minute, I saw where it fell. In less than a minute he was back in the cab with the ring. But within that minute a crosstown car had stopped directly in front of the cab. The cabman tried to pass to the left, but a heavy express wagon cut him off. He tried the right, and had to back away from a furniture van that had no business to be there. He tried to back out, but dropped his reins and swore dutifully. He was blockaded in a tangled mess of vehicles and horses. One of those street blockades had occurred that sometimes tie up commerce and movement quite suddenly in the big city. Why don't you drive on? Said Miss Lantry, impatiently. We'll be late. Richard stood up in the cab and looked around. He saw a congested flood of wagons, trucks, cabs, vans and streetcars filling the vast space where Broadway, 6th Avenue and 34th Street cross one another as a 26-inch maiden fills her 22-inch girdle. And still from all the cross streets they were hurrying and rattling toward the converging point at full speed and hurling themselves into the struggling mass, locking wheels and adding their drivers' imprecations to the clamor. The entire traffic of Manhattan seemed to have jammed itself around him. The oldest New Yorker among the thousands of spectators that lined the sidewalks had not witnessed a street blockade of the proportions of this one. "I'm very sorry," said Richard, as he resumed his seat, "but it looks as if we are stuck. They won't get this jumble loosened up in an hour. It was my fault. If I hadn't dropped the ring, let me see the ring," said Miss Landry. "Now that it can't be helped, I don't care. I think theaters are stupid, anyway." At 11 o'clock that night, somebody tapped lightly on Anthony Rockwall's door. "Come in," shouted Anthony, who was in a red dressing gown, reading a book of piratical adventures. Somebody was Aunt Ellen, looking like a gray-haired angel that had been left on Earth by mistake. "They're engaged, Anthony," she said, softly. "He has promised to marry our Richard." On their way to the theater there was a street blockade, and it was 2 hours before their cab could get out of it. "And oh, Brother Anthony, don't ever boast of the power of money again. A little emblem of true love, a little ring, that symbolized unending and unmercenary affection was the cause of our Richard finding his happiness. He dropped it in the street, and got out to recover it. And before they could continue, the blockade occurred. He spoke to his love, and won her there, while the cab was hemmed in. Money is dross compared with true love, Anthony." "All right," said old Anthony. "I'm glad the boy has got what he wanted. I told him I wouldn't spare any expense in the matter but, Brother Anthony, what good could your money have done?" "Sister," said Anthony Rockwall, "I've got my pirate in a devil of a scrape. His ship has just been scuttled, and he's too good a judge of the value of money to let drown. I wish you would let me go on with this chapter. The story should end here. I wish it would as heartily as you who read it wish it did. But we must go to the bottom of the well for truth." The next day a person with red hands, and a blue polka dot necktie, who called himself Kelly, called at Anthony Rockwall's house, and was at once received in the library. "Well," said Anthony, reaching for his checkbook, "it was a good bilin of soap. Let's see, you had $5,000 in cash." "I paid out $300 more of my own," said Kelly. "Had to go a little above the estimate. I got the express wagons and cabs mostly for $5. But the trucks and two horse teams mostly raised me to $10. The motormen wanted $10, and some of the loaded teams $20. The cops struck me hardest $50 I paid too, and the rest $20 and $25. But didn't it work beautiful, Mr. Rockwall? I'm glad William A. Brady wasn't on too, that little outdoor vehicle mob scene. I wouldn't want William to break his heart with jealousy. And never a rehearsal either. The boys was on time to the fraction of a second. It was 2 hours before a snake could get below Greeley's statue." "1300 there you are, Kelly," said Anthony, tearing off a check. "Our $1,000, and the $300 you were out. You don't despise money, do you, Kelly?"
"Me?"
said Kelly. "Can lick the man that invented poverty." Anthony called Kelly when he was at the door. "You didn't notice," said he, "anywhere in the tie-up, a kind of a fat boy without any clothes on shooting arrows around with a bow, did you?"
"Why, no," said Kelly, mystified.
"Didn't. If he was like you say, maybe the cops pinched him before I got there. I thought the little rascal wouldn't be on hand," chuckled Anthony. "Goodbye, Kelly." Springtime a la carte, it was a day in March. Never, never begin a story this way when you write one. No opening could possibly be worse. It is unimaginative, flat, dry and likely to consist of mere wind. But in this instance it is allowable. For the following paragraph, which should have inaugurated the narrative, is too wildly extravagant and preposterous to be flaunted in the face of the reader without preparation. Sarah was crying over her bill of fare. Think of a New York girl shedding tears on the menu card.
To account for this, you will be allowed to guess that the lobsters were all out, or that S.E. had sworn ice cream off during Lent, or that S.E. had ordered onions, or that S.E. had just come from a Hackett matinee. And then, all these theories being wrong, you will please let the story proceed. The gentleman who announced that the world was an oyster which he with his sword would open made a larger hit than he deserved. It is not difficult to open an oyster with a sword. But did you ever notice anyone try to open the terrestrial bivouac with a typewriter? Like to wait for a dozen raw opens that way? Sarah had managed to pry apart the shells with her unhandy weapon far enough to nibble a wee bit at the cold and clammy world within. She knew no more shorthand than if S.E. had been a graduate in stenography just let slip upon the world by a business college. So, not being able to stenog, she could not enter that bright galaxy of office talent. She was a freelance typewriter, and canvassed for odd jobs of copying. The most brilliant and crowning feat of Sarah's battle with the world was the deal she made with Schulenberg's home restaurant. The restaurant was next door to the old red brick in which she ballroomed. One evening after dining at Schulenberg's 40-cent, 5-course tilde table D'HOTE tilde served as fast as you throw the 5 baseballs at the colored gentleman's head, Sarah took away with her the bill of fare. It was written in an almost unreadable script, neither English nor German, and so arranged that if you were not careful you began with a toothpick, and rice pudding and ended with soup, and the day of the week. The next day Sarah showed Schulenberg a neat card on which the menu was beautifully typewritten with the viands temptingly marshaled under their right and proper heads from hors d'oeuvre to hot responsible for overcoats and umbrellas. Schulenberg became a naturalized citizen on the spot. Before Sarah left him, S.E. Adam willingly committed to an agreement. She was to furnish typewritten bills of fare for the 21 tables in the restaurant, a new bill for each day's dinner, and new ones for breakfast and lunch as often as changes occurred in the food, or as neatness required. In return for this, Schulenberg was to send 3 meals per diem to Sarah's hall room by a waiter, an obsequious one, if possible, and furnish her each afternoon with a pencil draft of what fate had in store for Schulenberg's customers on the morrow. Mutual satisfaction resulted from the agreement. Schulenberg's patrons now knew what the food they ate was called, even if its nature sometimes puzzled them. And Sarah had food during a cold, dull winter, which was the main thing with her. And then the almanac lied and said that spring had come. Spring comes when it comes. The frozen snows of January still lay like adamant in the crosstown streets. The hand organs still played, and the good old summertime, with their December vivacity and expression. Men began to make 30-day notes to buy Easter dresses. Janitors shut off steam. And when these things happen, one may know that the city is still in the clutches of winter. One afternoon Sarah shivered in her elegant hall bedroom. House heated, scrupulously clean, conveniences, seen to be appreciated. S.E. had no work to do except Schulenberg's menu cards. Sarah sat in her squeaky willow rocker and looked out the window. The calendar on the wall kept crying to her. Springtime is here, Sarah, springtime is here, I tell you. Look at me, Sarah, my figures show it. You've got a neat figure yourself. Sarah, a nice springtime figure, why do you look out the window so sadly? Sarah's room was at the back of the house. Looking out the window, she could see the windowless rear brick wall of the box factory on the next street. But the wall was clearest crystal, and Sarah was looking down a grassy lane shaded with cherry trees and elms and bordered with raspberry bushes and Cherokee roses. Spring's real harbingers are too subtle for the eye and ear. Some must have the flowering crocus, the wood-starring dogwood, the voice of bluebird, even so gross a reminder as the farewell handshake of the retiring buckwheat and oyster, before they can welcome the lady in green to their dull bosoms. But to old Earth's choicest kin there come straight, sweet messages from his newest bride, telling them they shall be no stepchildren, unless they choose to be. On the previous summer Sarah had gone into the country, and loved a farmer. In writing your story never hark back thus. It is bad art, and cripples interest. Let it march, march.
Sarah stayed 2 weeks at Sunnybrook Farm. There she learned to love old Farmer Franklin's son Walter. Farmers have been loved and wedded and turned out to grass in less time. But young Walter Franklin was a modern agriculturist. He had a telephone in his cowhouse, and he could figure up exactly what effect next year's Canada wheat crop would have on potatoes planted in the dark of the moon. It was in this shaded and raspberried lane that Walter had wooed and won her. And together they had sat and woven a crown of dandelions for her hair. He had immoderately praised the effect of the yellow blossoms against her brown tresses, and as he had left the chaplet there and walked back to the house swinging her straw sailor in her hands. They were to marry in the spring at the very first signs of spring, Walter said. And Sarah came back to the city to pound her typewriter. A knock at the door dispelled Sarah's visions of that happy day. A waiter had brought the rough pencil draft of the home restaurant's next day fare in old Schulenberg's angular hand. Sarah sat down to her typewriter and slipped a card between the rollers. She was a nimble worker. Generally in an hour and a half the 21 menu cards were written and ready. Today there were more changes on the bill of fare than usual. The soups were lighter. Pork was eliminated from the entrees, figuring only with Russian turnips among the roasts. The gracious spirit of spring pervaded the entire menu. Lamb, that lately capered on the greening hillsides, was becoming exploited with the sauce that commemorated its gambols. The song of the oyster, though not silenced, was tilde diminuendo con amore tilde. The frying pan seemed to be held, inactive, behind the beneficent bars of the broiler. The pie list swelled, the richer puddings had vanished. The sausage, with his drapery wrapped about him, barely lingered in a pleasant thanatopsis with the buckwheats, and the sweet but doomed maple. Sarah's fingers danced like midgets above a summer stream. Down through the courses she worked, giving each item its position according to its length with an accurate eye. Just above the desserts, came the list of vegetables. Carrots and peas, asparagus on toast, the perennial tomatoes and corn and succotash, lima beans, cabbage, and then, Sarah was crying over her bill of fare. Tears from the depths of some divine despair rose in her heart and gathered to her eyes. Down went her head on the little typewriter stand, and the keyboard rattled a dry accompaniment to her moist sobs. For as he had received no letter from Walter in 2 weeks, and the next item on the bill of fare was dandelions with some kind of egg, but bother the egg, dandelions, with whose golden blooms Walter had crowned her his queen of love and future bride dandelions, the harbingers of spring, her sorrow's crown of sorrow reminder of her happiest days. Madam, I dare you to smile until you suffer this test. Let the marital kneel roses that Percy brought you on the night you gave him your heart be served as a salad with French dressing before your eyes at a Schulenberg tilde table d'hote. Had Juliet so seen her love tokens dishonored, the sooner would she have sought the Lethean herbs of the good apothecary. But what a witch's spring! Into the great cold city of stone and iron a message had to be sent. There was none to convey it, but the little hardy courier of the fields with his rough green coat and modest air. He is a true soldier of fortune, this tilde dent de lion tilde this lion's tooth, as the French chefs call him. Flowered, he will assist at love-making, wreathed in my lady's nut-brown hair, young and callow and unblossomed, he goes into the boiling pot and delivers the word of his sovereign mistress. By and by Sarah forced back her tears. The cards must be written. But, still in a faint, golden glow from her dandelion dream, she fingered the typewriter keys absently for a little while, with her mind and heart in the meadow lane with her young farmer. But soon she came swiftly back to the rock-bound lanes of Manhattan, and the typewriter began to rattle and jump like a strike-breaker's motor car.
At 6 o'clock the waiter brought her dinner and carried away the typewritten bill of fare. When Sarah ate, she set aside, with a sigh, the dish of dandelions with its crowning of various accompaniment. As this dark mass had been transformed from a bright and love-induced flower to be an ignominious vegetable, so had her summer hopes wilted and perished. Love may, as Shakespeare said, feed on itself. But Sarah could not bring herself to eat the dandelions that had graced, as ornaments, the first spiritual banquet of her heart's true affection. At 7:30 the couple in the next room began to quarrel. The man in the room above sought 4 A on his flute, the gas went a little lower, 3 coal wagons started to unload the only sound, of which the phonograph was jealous, cats on the back fences slowly retreated toward Muckton. By these signs Sarah knew that it was time for her to read. She got out The Cloister and the Hearth, the best non-selling book of the month, settled her feet on her trunk, and began to wander with Gerard. The front door bell rang. The landlady answered it. Sarah left Gerard and Denise Reed by a bear and listened. Oh, yes, he would, just as she did. And then a strong voice was heard in the hall below, and Sarah jumped for her door, leaving the book on the floor, and the first round easily the bear's. You have guessed it. She reached the top of the stairs just as her farmer came up, 3 at a jump, and reaped and garnered her, with nothing left for the gleaners. Why haven't you written? Oh, why? Cried Sarah. New York is a pretty large town, said Walter Franklin. Came in a week ago to your old address. I found that you went away on a Thursday. That consoled some. It eliminated the possible Friday bad luck. But it didn't prevent my hunting for you with police and otherwise ever since. I wrote, said Sarah, vehemently. Never got it. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.